The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Ken Kalfas. It's a terrific honor to introduce my friend Jonathan Franzen tonight at the Free Library. I've been asked to remind you to turn off all your cell phones, phasers on stun, and also no pictures during the reading or even in the hallway, please. Okay, you can take pictures of me if you like, but otherwise, no pictures. Anyway, Jonathan Franzen is the author of four immensely compelling novels and two collections of provocative nonfiction. His third novel, The Corrections, won a National Book Award in 2001. His fourth, Freedom, has been hailed as a masterpiece on the front page of the New York Times Book Review. It's been called a work of genius in New York Magazine. He's been on the cover of Time Magazine. He's also the recipient of our nation's greatest civilian honor, a guest appearance on The Simpsons. I have to mention that Jonathan has a deep, abiding connection with Philadelphia. He graduated Swarthmore in 1981 and lived in the city in the early 90s. Philadelphia is one of several American cities indelibly etched in The Corrections. The novel includes a couple who lives in a house on Panama Street and a high-end cook who lives on Federal. Together, they start a restaurant in a former Pico generating building. In Freedom, the Philadelphia Sofitel makes a cameo appearance as a locus of desperate, doomed sexual desire, which is exactly how I've always thought of it. I don't know. Freedom has been hailed as a book that captures the qualities of a 19th century novel. Its rich, complex characters, its involved storyline, its tangled but familiar moral dilemmas. At the same time, it's a deeply contemporaneous novel, sensitive to our current politics and to our environmental crises. Jonathan's characters in all his novels are invariably inhabited by the spirit of their times. Often they're haunted by it. Freedom is a vital book, a book that demands your attention now, tonight, and in the enduring future of the American novel. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan Franzen.
Thank you. Thank you. It's so nice to be here. For my first trick, I'm going to make this picture disappear. That sounded canned, but it wasn't, actually. No, it's great to come back to Philly. And Ken read the Sofitel reference exactly as it was meant to be read. I'm staying there tonight. So I've been asked to tax you for an hour. And which will consist half of my reading to you and the other half in my interacting and Q&A. Where is Doris, just so I can see her? Hi. My dear friends from Swarthmore are here. So it's really hard to read for that amount of time. There's a good 37-minute reading, and there's a very good 50-minute reading. What we're getting instead tonight, I'm going to start in the middle of the book. and read for a short while, and then stop before the chapter even really gets fully off the ground. But this is backstory, and it actually, chronologically, it's one of the oldest things in the book, and I don't think much is being given away by my reading it, even though it's in the middle. It's a chapter called Womanland, and I'm just going to read like the first quarter of it. And it's about a young man named Joey Berglund in 2001. A lot of different women in Joey's life. And this is about, in high school, he moved out of his parents' house and in with the family next door, the Monahans, where his girlfriend lived. That is his girlfriend, Connie Monahan, and his parents and the neighbors didn't get along very well. Now he's gone off to college, paying his own way. I made the mistake of swallowing a Tylenol because the humidity had suddenly kind of given me a headache, and I did it dry-mouthed on the way over here. And now I have the sense that the pill is sort of dissolving somewhere halfway down. So if I collapse... yeah, I know, I'm drinking water. I've been pounding the water, but it just... You know, as you get older, there are these little crannies that seem to develop kind of on the way down. Too much information, I know. Okay, sorry. Chapter is called Womanland, and I'll be stopping more or less in mid-sentence. Growing up in St. Paul, Joey Berglund had received numberless assurances that his life was destined to be a lucky one. The way star halfbacks talk about a great open field run, the sense of cutting and weaving at full speed through a defense that moved in slow motion, the entire field of play as all visible and instantaneously graspable as a video game at rookie level, was the way every facet of his life had felt for his first 18 years. The world had given unto him, and he was fine with taking. He arrived as a first-year student in Charlottesville with the ideal clothes and haircut, and found that the school had paired him with a perfect roommate from Nova, as the locals called the Virginia suburbs of D.C. For 2.5 weeks, college looked like it would be an extension of the world as he had always known it, only better. He was so convinced of this, took it so much for granted, that on the morning of September 11, he actually left his roommate, Jonathan, to monitor the burning World Trade Center in Pentagon while he hurried off to his Econ 201 lecture. Not until he reached the big auditorium and found it all but empty did he understand that a really serious glitch had occurred. Skipping a paragraph. In the days after 9/11, everything suddenly seemed extremely stupid to Joey. It was stupid that a vigil of concern was held for no conceivable reason. It was stupid that people kept watching the same disaster footage over and over. It was stupid that the Ki-Fi boys hung a banner of support from their house. And it was stupid that the football game against Penn State was canceled. It was stupid that so many kids left grounds to be with their families. And it was stupid that everybody at Virginia said grounds instead of campus. The four liberal kids on Joey's hall had endless stupid arguments with the 20 conservative kids, as if anybody cared what a bunch of 18-year-olds thought about the Middle East. A stupidly big fuss was made about the students who'd lost relatives or family friends in the attacks, as if the other kinds of horrible death that were constantly occurring in the world mattered less. And there was stupid applause when a van full of upperclassmen solemnly departed for New York to give succor to the Ground Zero workers, as if there weren't enough people in New York to do the job. Joey just wanted normal life to return as fast as possible. He felt as if he'd bumped his old Discman against a wall and knocked its laser out of a track he'd been enjoying and into a track he didn't recognize or like and also couldn't make stop playing. Before long, he was so lonely and isolated and hungry for familiar things that he made the rather serious mistake of giving Connie Monahan permission to take a Greyhound bus to visit him in Charlottesville, thereby undoing a summer's worth of spade work to prepare her for their inevitable breakup. All summer, he'd labored to impress on Connie the importance of not getting together for at least 9 months so as to test their feelings for each other. The idea was to develop independent selves and see if these selves were still a good match, but to Joey, this was no more a test than a high school chemistry experiment was research. Connie would end up staying in Minnesota while he pursued a business career and met girls who were more exotic and advanced and connected, or so he'd imagined before 9/11. He was careful to schedule Connie's visit while Jonathan was at home in Nova for a Jewish holiday. She spent the entire weekend camped out on Joey's bed with her overnight bag beside her on the floor, zipping her things back inside it as soon as she was done with them, as if trying to minimize her footprint. While Joey endeavored to read Plato for a Monday morning class, she pored over the faces in his first-year Facebook and laughed at the ones with odd expressions or unfortunate names. By Joey's reliable count, they had sex 8 times in 40 hours, stoning themselves repeatedly on the hydroponic bud she'd brought along. When it came time to take her back to the bus station, he loaded a bunch of new songs onto her MP3 player for the punishing 20-hour return trip to Minnesota. The sorry truth was that he felt responsible for her, knew he needed to break up with her anyway, and couldn't think how. At the bus station, he raised the subject of her education, which she'd promised to pursue, but somehow in her obdurate way, without explanation, hadn't. "You need to start taking classes in January," he told her. "Start at Inverhills and then maybe transfer to the U next year." "Okay," she said. "You're really smart," he said. "You can't just keep being a waitress." "Okay." She looked away desolately at the line forming by her bus. "I'll do it for you." "Not for me, for you, like you promised." She shook her head. "You just want me to forget about you." "Not true, not true at all," Joey said, although it was fairly true. "I'll go to school," she said, "but it's not going to make me forget about you. Nothing's going to make me forget about you." "Right," he said, "but we still need to find out who we are. We both need to do some growing." "I already know who I am." "Maybe you're wrong, though. Maybe you still need to..." "No," she said, "I'm not wrong. I only want to be with you. That's all I want in my life. You're the best person in the world. You can do anything you want, and I can be there for you. You'll own lots of companies, and I can work for you. Or you can run for president, and I'll work for your campaign. I'll do the things nobody else will do. If you need somebody to break the law, I'll do that for you. If you want children, I'll raise them for you." Joey was aware of needing his wits about him to reply to this rather alarming declaration. But he was unfortunately still somewhat stoned. "Here's the thing I want you to do," he said. "I want you to get a college education. Like, for example," he unwisely added, "if you were going to work for me, you'd need to know a lot of different stuff." "That's why I said I'd go to school for you," Connie said. "Weren't you listening?" He was beginning to see, as he hadn't in St. Paul, that things' prices weren't always evident at first glance, that the really big ballooning of the interest charges on his high school pleasures might still lie ahead of him. "We'd better get in line," he said, "if you want a good seat." "Okay." "Also," he said, "I think we should go at least a week without calling. We need to get back to being more disciplined." "Okay," she said, and walked obediently toward the bus. Joey followed with her overnight bag. He at least didn't have to worry about her making any scenes. She'd never been a compromiser of him, never an insister on sidewalk hand-holding, never a clinger, a pouter, a reproacher. She saved up all of her ardor for when they were alone. She was a specialist like that. When the bus doors opened, she stabbed him with one burning look and then handed her bag to the driver and boarded. There was no bullshit about waving through the window or making kissy faces. She put her earphones in her ears and slouched down out of sight. There was no bullshit in the weeks that followed either. Connie obediently refrained from calling him, and as the national fever began to break and autumn deepened on the Blue Ridge, Joey attended blowout Cavalier football losses and worked out at the gym and gained numerous pounds of beer weight. He gravitated socially to hallmates from prosperous families who believed in carpet-bombing the Islamic world until it learned to behave itself. He wasn't right-wing himself, but was comfortable with those who were. Reaming Afghanistan wasn't exactly what his sense of dislocation demanded, but it was close enough to afford some satisfaction. Only when enough beer had been consumed to bring a group conversation around to sex did he feel isolated. His thing with Connie was too intense and strange, too sincere, too muddled with love, to be fungible as coin of bragging. He disdained but also envied his hallmates for their communal bravado, their porny avowals of what they wanted to do with the choicest babes in the Facebook, or had supposedly done in isolated instances while wasted and seemingly without regret or consequence, to various wasted girls at their academies and prep schools. His hallmates' yearnings all still largely centered on the blowjob, which Joey apparently was totally alone in considering little more than a glorified jerk-off, an amusement for the parking lot at lunch hour. Masturbation itself was a demeaning dissipation, whose utility he was nevertheless learning to value as he sought to wean himself from Connie. His preferred venue for release was the handicapped bathroom in the science library, at whose reserve desk he collected $7.65 an hour for reading textbooks in the Wall Street Journal and occasionally fetching texts for science nerds. Landing a work-study job at the reserve desk had seemed to him yet another confirmation that he was destined to be fortunate in life. He was astonished that the library still possessed printed matter of such rarity and widespread interest that it had to be guarded in separate stacks and not allowed to leave the building. There was no way it wouldn't all be digitized within the next few years. Many of the reserve texts were written in formerly popular foreign languages and illustrated with sumptuous color plates. It could even dignify masturbation a little bit to use a century-old German sexual anatomy atlas as an auxiliary to it. He knew that sooner or later he would need to break his silence with Connie, but at the end of each evening, after employing the paddle-handled handicapped faucets to wash his gametes and prostatic fluids down the drain, he decided to risk waiting one more day until finally, late one evening, at the reserve desk, on the very day he realized he probably waited one day too long, he got a call from Connie's mother. "Carol," he said amiably, "hello." "Hello, Joey. You probably know why I'm calling." "No, actually, I don't." "Well, you've just about broken our little friend's heart is why." Stomach lurching, he retreated to the privacy of the stacks. "I was going to call her tonight," he told Carol. "Tonight? Really? You were going to call her tonight?" "Yes." "Why do I not believe you?" "I don't know." "Well, she's gone to bed, so it's good you didn't call. She went to bed without eating. She went to bed at 7. "Good thing I didn't call then." "This isn't funny, Joey. She's very depressed. You've given her a depression, and you need to stop messing around. You understand? My daughter isn't some dog that you can tie to a parking meter and then forget about." "Maybe you should get her an antidepressant." "She's not your pet that you can leave in the back seat with the windows rolled up," Carol said, warming to her metaphor. "We're part of your life, Joey. I think we deserve a little more than the nothing you've been giving us. This has been a very frightening fall for all concerned, and you have been absent." "You know, I do have classes to attend and so forth." "Too busy for a 5-minute phone call after 3.5 weeks of silence." "I really was going to call her tonight." "Never mind Connie," even Carol said. "Leave Connie out of it for a minute. You and I lived together like a family for almost 2 years. I never thought I'd hear myself saying this, but I'm starting to get an idea of what you put your mom through. Seriously, I never understood how cold you are until this fall." Joey directed a smile of pure oppression at the ceiling. There had always been something not quite right about his interactions with Carol. She was what the prep school boys on his hall and the frat brothers who were rushing him were wont to call a MILF, an acronym that in Joey's opinion sounded faintly cretinous for its omission of the T for two. Although he was generally a very sound sleeper, there had occasionally been nights during the period of his residency at the Monahans when he'd awakened in Connie's bed with strange, anxious premonitions of himself, as the unwitting and horrified trespasser of his sister's bed, for example, or as the accidental shooter of a nail into Blake's forehead with Blake's nail gun, or, strangest of all, as the towering crane at a major Great Lakes dockyard, his horizontal member swinging heavy containers off the deck of a mothership and gently depositing them on a smaller, flatter barge. These visions tended to follow moments of inappropriate connection with Carol. The glimpse of her bare butt through the nearly closed door of her and Blake's bedroom, the complicit wink she gave Joey pursuant to a dinner table belch from Blake, the lengthy and explicit rationale she presented to him for putting Connie on the pill. Since Connie was constitutionally incapable of being displeased with Joey, It had fallen to her mother to register her discontents. Carol was Connie's garrulous organ, her straight-talking advocate, and Joey had sometimes had the sense, on weekend nights when Blake was out with buddies, of being the sandwiched party in a virtual threesome, Carol's mouth running and running with all the things that Connie wouldn't say, Connie then silently doing with Joey all the things that Carol couldn't do, and Joey jolting awake in the wee hours with a sense of entrapment in something not quite right. A little gloss on MILF follows there. We're omitting that tonight. So what am I supposed to do, he said. Well, for starters, I want you to be a more responsible boyfriend. I'm not her boyfriend. We're on hiatus. What is hiatus? What does that mean? It means we're experimenting with being apart. That's not what Connie tells me. Connie tells me you want her to go to school so she can learn administrative skills and be your assistant in your endeavors. Look, Joey said, Carol, I was stoned when I said that. I mistakenly said the wrong thing while stoned on the incredibly strong pot that Connie buys. You think I don't know she smokes pot? You think Blake and I don't have noses? You're not telling me anything I don't know. All you do is make yourself look like a bad boyfriend when you try to snitch on her. My point is that I said the wrong thing, and I haven't had a chance to correct myself because we agreed not to talk for a while. And whose responsibility is that? You know you're like a god to her, literally like a god, Joey. You tell her to hold her breath, she'll hold her breath until she faints. You tell her to sit in a corner, she'll sit in a corner till she keels over with starvation. Well, and whose fault is that, Joey said. It's yours. No, Carol, it's yours. You're the parent. You're the one whose house she's living in. I just came along. Yeah, and now you're going your own way without taking responsibility. After being all but married to her, after being part of our family. Whoa, Carol, I'm a freshman in college. Do you understand that? I mean, the weirdness of our even having this conversation? I understand that when I was 1 year older than you are now, I had a baby girl and was having to make my own way in the world. And how's that working out for you? Not too bad, as a matter of fact. I wasn't going to tell you this because it's still early on, but since you asked, Blake and I are going to have a little baby. Our little family's about to get a little bigger. It took Joey a moment to compute that she was telling him that she was pregnant. Listen, he said, I'm still at work. I mean, congratulations and all. I'm just busy at this particular moment. Busy, right. I promise I'll call her tomorrow afternoon. No, I'm sorry, Carol said. That won't do it. You need to come out right away and spend some time with her. That's not an option. Then come for a week at Thanksgiving. We'll have a nice family Thanksgiving, all four of us. It'll give her something to look forward to, and you can see for yourself how depressed she is. Joey had been planning to spend the holiday in Washington with his roommate, Jonathan, whose older sister, a junior at Duke, either photographed misleadingly well or was somebody not to miss meeting in person. The sister's name was Jenna, which in Joey's mind connected her to the Bush twins and all the partying and loose morals that the Bush name connoted. I don't have money for a flight, he said. You can take a bus, just like Connie. Or is the bus not good enough for Joey Berglund? I also have other plans. Well, you better change your plans, Carol said. Skipping a little bit down, the scene goes on and gets slightly worse yet for Joey. After the library closed, he went out into the chilly night and sat on a bench outside his dorm. As if to reassure himself that Carol had been wrong about him, meaning his coldness, he wept a little in the darkness on a bench, wept for Connie and her misery, wept for having abandoned her to Carol, for not being the person who could save her. Then he dried his eyes and called his own mother, whose telephone Carol could probably have heard ringing if she'd stood by a window and listened closely. Joseph Berglund, his mother said. I seem to remember that name from somewhere. Hi, Mom. Immediately a silence. Sorry I haven't called in a while, he said. Oh, well, she said, there's really nothing much happening around here except anthrax scares, a very unrealistic realtor trying to sell our house, and your dad flying back and forth to Washington. You know they make everybody flying into Washington stay in their seat for an hour before they land there? It seems like kind of a weird regulation. I mean, what are they thinking? The terrorists are going to cancel their evil plan because the seatbelt sign is on? Dad says they're barely even airborne when the stewardesses start warning everybody to use the bathroom right away before it's too late. And then they start handing out whole cans of drinks. She sounded like a nattering older lady, not the vital force he still imagined when he allowed himself to think of her. He had to squeeze his eyes shut to avert renewed weeping. Everything he'd done with regard to her in the last 3 years had been calculated to foreclose the intensely personal sort of talks they'd had when he was younger, to get her to shut up, to train her to contain herself, to make her stop pestering him with her overfull heart and her uncensored self. And now that the training was complete and she was obediently trivial with him, he felt bereft of her and wanted to undo it. "Am I allowed to ask if all is well with you?" she said. "Everything is well with me. Life's good in the former slave states?" "Very good. The weather's been beautiful." "Right, that's the advantage of growing up in Minnesota. Everywhere you go now, the weather will be nicer." "Yep." "Are you making lots of new friends, meeting lots of people?" "Yep." "Well, good, good, good. Good, good, good. It's nice of you to call, Joey. I mean, I know you don't have to, so it's nice that you did. You have some real fans here back at home." A herd of male first-years burst out of the dorm and onto the lawn, their voices amplified by beer. "Joey, Joey," they lowed affectionately. He nodded to them in cool acknowledgement. "Sounds like you've got some fans there, too," his mother said. "Yep. My popular boy." "Yep." Another silence fell as the herd headed off to fresh watering holes. Joey felt a pang of disadvantage watching them go. He was already nearly a month ahead of his budgeted fall semester spending. He didn't want to be the poor kid who drank only one beer while everybody else was having six, but he didn't want to look like a freeloader either. He wanted to be dominant and generous, and this required funds. "How's Dad liking his new job?" he made an effort to ask his mother. "I think he's liking it okay. It's sort of driving him insane. You know, suddenly having lots of somebody else's money to spend on fixing all the things he thinks are wrong with the world. He used to be able to complain that nobody was fixing them. Now he actually has to try to fix them himself, which is impossible, of course, since we're all going to hell in a handbasket. He sends me emails at 3 a.m. I don't think he's sleeping much." "And what about you? How are you?" "Oh, well, it's nice of you to ask, but you don't really want to know." "Sure I do." "No, trust me, you don't. And don't worry, I'm not saying that in a mean way. It's not a reproach. You've got your life. I've got mine. It's all good, good, good." "No, but, like, what do you do all day?" "Actually, FYI," his mother said, "that can be a somewhat awkward question to ask a person. It's sort of like asking a childless couple why they don't have any children, or an unmarried person why they aren't married. You have to be careful with certain kinds of questions that may seem perfectly innocuous to you." "I'm sort of in limbo right now," she said. "It's hard to make any big changes in my life when I know I'm going to be moving. I did start a little creative writing project for my private amusement. I also have to keep the house looking like a bed and breakfast in case a realtor stops by with a potential mark. I spend a lot of time making sure the magazines are nicely fanned." Joey's feeling of bereavement was giving way to irritation because no matter how much she denied that she was doing it, she couldn't seem to help reproaching him. These moms and their reproaches, there was no end to it. He called her for a little support, and the next thing he knew, he was falling short of providing support to her. "So how are you on money?" she said, as if sensing his irritation. "Do you have enough money?" "It's a little tight," he admitted. "I bet. Once I'm a resident here, tuition will go way down. It's just this first year that's really hard." "Do you want me to send you some money?" He smiled in the darkness. He liked her in spite of everything. He couldn't help it. "I thought Dad said there wasn't going to be any money." "Dad doesn't necessarily have to know every little thing. The school won't consider me a state resident if I'm taking anything from you. School doesn't have to know everything either. I could send you a check made out to cash if that would help you." "Yeah, and then what?" "Then nothing, I promise. No strings attached. I'm saying you've already made your point with Dad. There's no need to take on horrible debt at high interest just to keep proving a point you already made." "Let me think about it." "Why don't I just put a check in the mail to you? Then you can decide on your own if you want to cash it or not. You won't have to discuss it with me." He smiled again. "Why are you doing this?" "Well, you know, Joey, believe it or not, I want you to have the life you want to have. I've had some free time for asking myself questions while I've been fanning magazines on the coffee table. Like, if you were to tell me then, Dad, that you never wanted to see us again for the rest of your life, would I still want you to be happy?" That is a bizarre hypothetical question. It has no bearing on reality. That's nice to hear, but it's not my point. My point is that we all think we know the answer to the question. Parents are programmed to want the best for their kids, regardless of what they get in return. That's what love is supposed to be like, right? But in fact, if you think about it, that's kind of a strange belief, given what we know about the way people really are, selfish, short-sighted, egotistical, needy. Why should a parent, being a parent just in and of itself, somehow confer superior personhood on everybody who tries it? Obviously, it doesn't. I've told you a little bit about my own parents, for example. Not very much, Joey said. Well, maybe sometime I'll tell you more if you ask me nicely. But my point is that I've given some real thought to this question of love regarding you, and I've decided, Mom, do you mind if we stop talking about this? I've decided, or actually, you know, maybe some other day, next week or something. I've got a lot of stuff I need to do before I go to bed. A silence of injury descended in St. Paul. I'm sorry, he said. It's just really late, and I'm tired, and I still have stuff to do. I was simply explaining, his mother said in a much lower voice, why I'm going to send you a check. Right. Thank you. That's nice of you, I guess. In an even smaller and more injured voice, his mother thanked him for calling and hung up. Joey looked around the lawn for some bushes or an architectural cranny where he might cry unobserved by passing posses. Seeing none, he ran inside his dorm and blindly, as if needing to barf, veered into the first John he came to on a hall not his own and locked himself into his stall and sobbed with hatred of his mother. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very
much. There's some rich suspense toward the end. So now I'm going to take questions, if there are any.
So 10 years ago, Oprah wanted to put her seal on your book.
9 years ago.
What?
Nine years ago.
And you said no.
No.
What you said, I thought you didn't want the seal on the book, or you didn't want to be her book club pick because it was too, a lot of her book club picks were mundane or not highbrow enough. That was the concept I got. But 9 years later, it's okay. I mean, you've...
So what's
changed in 9 years between you and Oprah? Is that okay? I didn't give away any plot.
Communications between Oprah and me are definitely better, but far less has changed than you might know.
Okay, so
I never said I didn't want to be on Oprah. I didn't. Okay, so that's the first thing, and I don't really want to rehash all of that, but. But there were a couple of things that she didn't know that the writers who were getting picked were uncomfortable about, and I was the first person stupid enough to mention them in interviews, which was, you know, unfortunate in many ways, because it happened in a climate when people were desperately seeking an elitist, since Even billionaires who, you know, were claiming to be populists, you couldn't find an elitist. But if you really selectively quoted parts of my admittedly overlong sentences in certain interviews, you could make me out to be that, you know, mythical beast, the elitist who'd caused all the country's problems, like, you know, regulating clean air and clean water and things like that. So there was a cultural climate in which a battle that pitted a great populist against somebody who is known to be a terrible elitist was welcome and was, you know, it was, people loved it. People ate it up, particularly in the media. There's not to blame the media. So something, in fact, what I had been trying to say in these statements that were taken out of context was, yeah, there's this, this, and this, but in fact, Oprah and I are trying to do the very same thing. We're trying not to let this country to be divided into dopey categories of high and low and populist and elitist. And so one thing that's nice now is I have an opportunity to say for the, I mean, not by any means the first time, but to, like, this is what I meant. This is what I always meant. I never was Oprah's enemy. Oprah was never my enemy, right?
Yeah, I never got that.
Yeah.
I actually liked your decision.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't speak out. I was, it's really complicated, and I don't want to spend the evening talking about this. But she's also made, you know, in terms of the stickers and so forth, those are now peel-off stickers. Because, again, her people didn't realize that someone might want a book without one. That was news that came to them in response to things I'd said. Then the New York Times picked it up about people rooting through the piles looking for the non-Oprah edition. And they were like, why would you? And this just came as total news to them. So they got rid of that. And they got rid of the stupid B-roll, too, that I had found painful. And so, it's really nice. And it's nice not to feel like I'm misidentified as some hero to the, you know, to all of the enemies of Oprah. Because I never wanted that role, and I've always been uncomfortable with it. Yes, maybe this gentleman in the collared sports shirt. If that's not redundant.
Well, I've never read your other books, but I was...
No plot, right?
No. I was not, prompted to buy the book and start reading. I read about 50 pages. The review in the New York Times, the initial review that I read, claimed that this was, you know, the great American masterpiece, and it was praised in the highest terms. Then David Brooks the other day said, yeah.
The David Brooks?
Yeah. Am I saying something wrong? Okay, so he says that the book is extremely well written, you know, brilliantly written, but it doesn't have any answers to this flatness, I guess, in American culture that is evolved. And I was wondering what your thoughts were about that.
My thoughts were about
David Brooks'
criticism. I didn't read it. I don't read these things.
Okay, well, but, that's what he said. He said that, my understanding is that he said the book is well, brilliantly written, but does not offer any alternative.
Right.
And therefore it fails on that account.
Right. It's not a position paper. I will freely admit that. It would almost have been a disappointment if David Brooks had really liked the book. It would have just been too much. But he seems to be mistaking the productive work he does for the New York Times for the useless work that artists do. And applying the standards of high productivity that obtain in the world he lives in to the very low standards of social utility that obtain in the world of books. And I actually don't mean that ironically. You know, art makes nothing happen. So, I haven't read the piece though. Maybe you'll have. Thank you for the question. Thanks. Maybe it's this person way at the back in the cardigan, or whatever that is called.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you would comment a little bit on what your next project would be, and also if you will plan to do any more collections of essays as opposed to just novels.
I probably will. I have been writing essays apace for these last few years. I'm thinking of doing some more journalism.
Oh,
Is there another novel in the works?
I'm real busy right now promoting this one, so it's I don't wake up with a song in my heart in the morning and look at, you know, the first 4 hours of the day and think, I think I'll work on the novel, but it's there's very little time right now. So and in the works, I mean, I've been working full time as a novelist since 1982. And I have written four. And full-time, obviously, I've taken time off to do other things. But even when I was doing those other things, it was in the service of trying to get to the point where I could keep on writing novels. It's what I set out to do. It's what I do. But, you know, that is 28 years, so that's every 7 years. So I would love to have it be 5 years this time. But it's just the idea of even thinking about it right now is impossible. Thank you. Maybe this woman here on the...
You have a wonderful passage on page 158. Beautiful. I'm not going to give anything away.
Okay.
And it reminded me of something that I would read in Proust. So I was just curious what influences, what other writers that you're influenced by, because I just picked that vibe up from that passage.
Pretty much every good writer I've ever read is, in some sense, a writer to learn something from. But, you know, it's not... Fiction writing isn't some craft that gets handed down through studios where, you know... There's the grand master, and then there are the earnest imitators, and people take a little bit of from this style and a little bit of from that style. It's not. It's just not the way it works. It's not. There aren't many new tricks for the novelist that weren't already pretty well known by about 1760. As a glance at. Fielding or Smollett or Lawrence Stern will show you in the English language. So what it doesn't really make a lot of sense to talk about influence, especially if you're past the age of like 30. When I was first starting out, I was very, very taken with Robert Coover's novel, The Origin of the Brunists, when I was about 24. Coover, I think, is an underspoken of American writer. He was doing really interesting work. He was one of the really smart experimental writers of the 70s and 80s. And I was very taken with that, and I think I copied how he was doing sentences and how he was building scenes. And when I got to DeLillo, I sort of, you know, DeLillo... You can't not copy from if you're a 27-year-old ambitious male fiction writer. You're going to be doing some copying, but that's like what you do at the very beginning. And what it's much more like later is you've read a lot, and you're just part of this big community. And there's a kind of living community of readers and writers, and the people who write are drawn from that community. They are also readers. And then there's also this virtual community. I have these ongoing developing relationships with writers who are dead through their work, which is the great thing about books. You know, you still are connecting mind to mind with somebody who's gone. And I have, you know, enemies and friends, and the enemies and friends change book by book, so it does the whole question of influence doesn't make any sense in that respect. Because why do you let yourself be influenced by somebody? Why are you drawn to one kind of writing and not to another? It's not that someone, you know, it's not that Dostoevsky pressed so much harder on the soft clay of my head than Joyce did. Because there are plenty of other writers who whose brains are getting, you know, pressed on by Joyce. And Joyce just didn't leave a mark on me. So So influence is a very peculiar thing. It's a good, strange notion. And I just move on to another question. Maybe this gentleman way at the back in the possibly green shirt. Next, this is an oddly stressful Q&A, I have to say. And then my apologies if I'm...
Well, hopefully this one won't be too stressful. You mentioned your journalism before, and one of the pieces that I really enjoyed over the last couple of years of yours was your profile of Speaker Hastert.
Dennis Hastert, yes.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that, you know, you've written a book with, you know, political themes and discussing what has happened to the country over the past 10 years. And having met Hastert, as well as, I believe, you know, the vice president, being face-to-face with Cheney and other
just
figures.
Actually voce a voce over the telephone. But.
Oh, okay. Having, you know, spoken and interviewed and talked to those people, did that have any effect? And what effect did it have on the themes and the content of freedom?
No diss to the earlier questions, but thank you for that excellent question. Seriously, no diss to the earlier questions, but I'm glad you asked. I really was trying. I had a firm intention of writing a Washington novel, and instead, there's just this little, almost vestigial piece of Washington in this one. All that remains of the grand Washington novel that I had been trying to write for several years, several whole years. I just kept trying to write a Washington novel. And that did, it was my interest in doing that led me to try to be the New Yorker's Washington correspondent. And the one piece I did was a profile of then Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, the longest serving Republican Speaker of the House in the nation's history. And also surely one of the least well known. And the striking experience that summer, it was a time when people, you know, liberal Democrats like me were kind of angry. And I went and spent the whole summer hanging out with these, not just sort of moderate Republicans, but pretty much the hardcore Tom DeLay, Club for Growth, far right in Washington at that time. Things, of course, have gotten even more extreme, much more extreme. That makes those guys look almost like moderates nowadays compared to what we're getting from the Tea Party edge. So for somebody who has the liberal gene, to go and hang out with these people, it was incredibly eye-opening to find how much I liked them. And that as long as we didn't talk about the size of government and taxation, everything was great. And it was just, the, you know, funny, ironic, sophisticated. I mean, not Dennis Hastert. Even Dennis Hastert, you know, much smarter and sexier than you would ever guess, reading about him or just listening to his voice. And it really got me thinking about what a strange thing political passion is, that here you have this, there was one guy in particular who drove me around northern Illinois and Indiana at speeds, which I kind of glanced over and realized, wow, he's doing 110 in this BMW. But you don't feel it in those big old BMWs. You just feel like the state lines are recurring shockingly often. And indeed, we overshot our mark by about 80 miles. So we're almost late for the event. Because, yeah, suddenly we were well up into Michigan. We hadn't noticed that we'd crossed the state line, and we were like, you know, 60 miles into Michigan. Because we were just having so much fun talking. He was this incredibly witty, funny, great guy. And it was just so striking that all it took was just like one tiny drop from the political vial, one drop of politics in an otherwise is enough to poison the whole thing. We could never be friends. I couldn't be friends with him because how could he possibly have those opinions? It wouldn't be fun to argue about it. It was just like, what, are you kidding me? So it really, I came away with a really deep sense of the mystery of how much a political our political convictions matter, and yet how arbitrary they are, and within the same family, and in a way, the Civil War is a story of that. You know, brother against brother. When you have these families, and you know, you get same parents, and you get people. You know, there's a drop of poison on each side, and they can't. And they so it's it it. And that's why I wanted to have a Republican in, as one of my main characters, which I do, and he's my favorite character. Actually, we'll just go, where's the mic? You, the mic is so close here. Sorry about that. Gentleman in the star T-shirt.
Yes, I have a question about time. I really love your writing, and some of it seems timeless, and a lot of it is actually very much of the current time. So the references to, you know, Discman or MILF, these things. How do you think this will be read, you know, in 10, 20, 30 years from now? Will how will somebody sort of understand these references, and what's your goal in mixing these?
Well, I there are plenty of people who, you know, there are plenty of people who don't understand some of the references even now. No, I mean, you know, there are some references that are probably, you know, pitched at, for an older reader, and there's some references that are pitched for much younger readers, and not everyone knows exactly the same, has the same set of cultural references as I do. I try where possible to provide enough context so that even if you're not getting the particular reference, you have a sense of what kind of reference it is. And I also take some care not to, like, have the payoff be that having that knowledge. Like, the payoff of the sentence is not contingent on your being party to the same cultural reference as I am. So if you, I feel as if you take reasonable care to provide some context and to not make the reader feel excluded from a series of in-jokes, that I don't really see what the problem is. I'm surprised by how often I'm getting asked this question, because it seems to me sort of unremarkable. And if you look back 100 years ago or 400 years ago, at the Renaissance plays, those were filled with all these, you know, Shakespeare's got all this stuff. We have no idea what he was talking about. Seriously, you have no idea what he's talking about. Obviously, it meant something. The audiences were all going, we can only guess. And, you know, scholars have been working for several centuries to try to, you know, piece together what it was. I don't expect there to be scholars doing that, you know, for books that I or my contemporaries write, but nevertheless, it doesn't disqualify Shakespeare that he was in fact living in a real time and referring to real people and real things. It in fact, you could almost argue the opposite, that you go to those kind of bloodless French classical tragedies, and he's like, oh my God, give us something contemporary, please. You know, it's just all these, you know, these kind of, these extremely formalized people, creatures from, you know, ancient times. And, you know, at least there are, like, modern-seeming people running around Shakespeare, and you have the sense, wow, this guy's really alive. So I don't really see what the problem is, and I'm puzzled by the persistence of the question. But I'm not challenging the authenticity of your curiosity. one more question. I've been, the finger has been held up. Two, if they're really quick. If it's like a yes-no thing. Oh, sorry, am I supposed to? Yes. This gentleman has been so eager at the back, and I it better be good.
Well, thank you for coming, first of all. I think everyone really had
a great time. You're very welcome. It's a great pleasure.
Despite the tenor of some earlier questions. Your novel, at least from the sections that you chose to read, is diagnostic of a sort of societal malaise and a sort of stunning, in fact, like whacking a mouse against the floor of a whole culture. But it's also dealing with the tension on an interpersonal level and families and how these things kind of break apart and go back together again. Do you think that this book is part of a tradition of other novels in American writing that have diagnosed kind of the larger questions of our time and families?
I want to take this opportunity to say directly to you, ma'am, that I was not running down your question, and it was an honestly asked question. And do I see myself as part of a tradition? Well, totally. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.